Uh-oh. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome, welcome to X Squared Radio. So glad you could join us here tonight. We're coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast, 83 degrees and clear. It was an awesome day in the southeast. Not so much for the northeastern people. They had to weather some very strange climate change this time of year for them. The solar wind is 336 kilometers per second, and there are 7 sunspot clusters on the sun right now. Sunspot 1465 harbors energy for C-class flares, and all of these sunspot clusters are aimed at the Earth right now. A minor coronal mass ejection that left the sun during the late hours yesterday is heading for Mars. En route, it will sweep past the Mars Science Lab spacecraft, which is carrying the latest Mars probe, Curiosity, to the Red Planet. According to a forecast track prepared by an analyst at the GSFC, the cloud will reach the rover aboard the spacecraft on May 4th. Fortunately, Curiosity is equipped to sense and study solar storms. How about that? So we're going to get live data from the spacecraft before the probe even gets to Mars. That's pretty cool. The brightest planet in the solar system is reaching its peak luminosity tomorrow, April 30th. Venus will shine at astronomical magnitude, get this, minus 4.7. On a scale of 1 to 10, that's about a 9.5. When you're talking about star magnitude, the more negative the number, the brighter the light. That's 190 times brighter than a first magnitude star, bright enough to see in broad daylight if your eye lands right on it. So, in the early morning or late afternoon, scan the sky for about where Venus should be, and you'll be able to see it in broad daylight. By the way, you know how a windy day will clean the leaves off the yard? Well, increasing solar activity tends to clean up satellite debris. Yeah, the wind sort of clears it out. Earth's atmosphere has been puffing up in response to increasing levels of UV radiation from sunspots. And this is good news for satellite operators because a puffed up atmosphere helps clean up low Earth orbit. The number of catalog debris in Earth orbit actually decreased during 2011. This reports Nick Johnson in NASA's Orbital Debris Quarterly newsletter. Can you believe that? They have a newsletter for it, Orbital Debris Quarterly. Even though only 6% of the total 3,218 cataloged debris from the ill-advised engagement had reentered by the end of 2011, half of these debris fell out of orbit in the past 12 months. That's not bad. Likewise, many debris from the 2009 accidental collision of Cosmos 2251 and Iridium 33 are accelerating their departure from Earth orbit. In the absence of a new major satellite breakup, the overall orbital debris population should continue to decrease during 2012 and 2013. Low orbit will get quite a bit safer for those projects we want to launch. No one has given much thought to what will happen to all the satellites in orbit if the solar wind is joined by a powerful galactic wind. Who knows? Maybe low orbit was cleaned up once before, during the last zenith of human existence. Ever wonder why we never saw any orbiting equipment up in space when Sputnik went up? Maybe we're not the first ones on the block after all. By the way, in space news, astronomers have found a new planet capable of supporting life. And before I talk about that, I am remiss because I've been off the air for 2 weeks. 2 weeks ago, I got tied up with other business relating to my day job. And last week, my trusty dusty Dell decided to go dark. Oh, the processor was running in the background, but the screen had nothing on it. It was dark. I think the inverter went bad in it. So being that this is a webcast radio program, I really couldn't come on and give you anything exciting because I didn't have access. So that's why we worked it out that way. We ran an archive last week, and I apologize for that. Normally, I'm very reliable. But this week, I'm on, and I'm a little out of sync. Can you believe that? We've been on the air here at BBS Radio. This September will make 7 years and 2 weeks out of the saddle, and you get out of the groove. And that's how it goes. So our phone number tonight is 888-429-5471. I know there's a lot going on out there. I know you know what it is. And I would like very much for you to call me with any ideas or controversies that you have, especially related to Scientific Talk Radio. There's a tremendous amount going on in political science right now. And I don't necessarily mean the politics of it. I mean, I don't care what the Democrats do and what the Republicans do. But I am interested in the political science of it. How the various, I was going to call them parties, but I want to use a better word. The various forces, we'll call them, have tried to position themselves. There's been a lot of name-calling. There's been a lot of posturing. There's been a lot of, you know what, the American public is really stupid and we can do anything we want kind of activities. But I don't really believe that. I get your emails. I read your texts. And by the way, if you want to contact me, I'm on Skype. And my address is X2-radio. So if you want to send me a message, you can do it that way. Very, very rapid and very reliable. And I also want to welcome my good friends Ramon in Japan right now with the 100th Monkey. He's doing a great job. His radio program's doing great. His new book is out, and we're going to have him on in a couple of weeks to talk about that as soon as I finish reading it. I have to read it twice. Pretty deep stuff. And a lot of neat things going on, and I want you to give me a call and talk about it. Content might be a little bit light tonight, so I'm going to have to catch the spirit and see what happens. But the political science is certainly pertinent because as we posture ourselves, both from an economic point of view and possibly an ideological point of view, it does not really matter what happens in the White House. What happens in our house. How do we posture our lives so that we could take advantage or at least make the most of the conditions, both in business and in sociological terms, to make the most of it? How do we get the most out of it? Where do we invest our money? Where do we keep our money out of? Where do we look for a job? What do we do with our interpersonal relationships in our community, our state, our nation? How do we posture our nation to get along with and work with for the future of other nations? These are great questions. I have seen the growing pains of very large nations, India, China, even Russia. Spoke to some people from the Ukraine this week. And honestly, the young people are in a quandary. I'm fascinated by it because as I speak to them, even though some of them have been working here in the United States or going to school here in the United States for a while, it is amazing to see how they are actually considering how things were when the Soviet Union was running things. You would think that with free market forces, democracy, freedom, all of that, that even though there are challenges, it's better than being subservient to mother government. Not exactly the response that I got. What I got was that they have been in the United States since, the mid-90s or so, just after the wall fell and everything kind of settled out. What actually happened in the Ukraine is that you have the very wealthy and you have the dirt poor. Very similar to what this country was right after the First World War. When the Great Depression occurred, which actually occurred a few months after Hoover took his inauguration in 1928, in 1932, Roosevelt, who was a governor before that, fairly well known, was elected very much out of protest against Hoover and what was going on at the time, but also because Wall Street, who Hoover was, you know, Wall Street's golden child, because he was an engineer, he was going to streamline things, he was going to allow business to be more interactive and more efficient with government, and it was. But what he didn't realize is that the forces that he was working with were so powerful and so greedy that the entire economy was headed south on purpose in order to create an investment playground for the very wealthy. And what it did very effectively was to antiseptically clean the middle class out of existence. So you had billionaires and you had people who worked for 25 cents a day and all the potatoes they could carry home. That is not the kind of free market economy that we would like to see. It's not the kind of market forces that we think are really dynamic and powerful and help a nation grow. What it did do is it depressed real estate to the point where literally you could buy a steamship for a dime. You could buy a skyscraper for a week's pay. And those that had cash, yes, there were people who had positioned themselves perfectly right at the right time with the right amount of cash, and they moved in and scooped up huge companies, tracts of land, and industrial relationships for pennies on the dollar. And it made it virtually impossible for the broke, who then became the poor, to rise out of it, because the wealthy was not going to provide any way for them to do it. They couldn't get the education, they couldn't get the skill levels, and even if they could, they couldn't get the capital to start anything. All the capital rested in very, very few hands. Enter Roosevelt. So in 1932, Roosevelt moves in, and many of the programs that Hoover had tried to get going from 1928 to 1932 and just couldn't get any traction with, all of a sudden, Hoover thought was the best thing since sliced bread, signed him into law. I mean, have you ever wondered about that? 1932, the election is over. In January of 1933, Roosevelt takes the inauguration. And literally within 90 days, you have 12 new agencies burst onto the scene, complete with leadership, management, budgets, plans. Everything was already laid out. Do you ever wonder about that? Why? How that happened? It was because Hoover and his cabinet had put all this together but couldn't get it passed. No. You see, the Democrats would not allow that stuff to pass. So when when Roosevelt became president, all of a sudden now it could happen because it was going to happen on Roosevelt's watch. And so things like the CCC and the FDIC and all of these things started falling into place as though they were all well-planned and well-oiled. And over the years, they've grown into the huge agency government that we have right now. The conditions were kind of strange, how they led up to the crash. It wasn't like everybody was rolling along, making dough, you know, just blowing and going, and nobody could do anything wrong. Every investment was great. Everything was grand. That's not how it happened at all. There were actually two major, major recessions and recoveries. And the country, after the second recession, had bounced back quite well, except the market, the stock market, was doing wonderfully, but the capital markets for business were still in the dirt, still going nowhere. And when you look at that economic condition, when you look at the scientific and mathematic conditions that were existing from 1928 to early 1932, they're almost identical to what they are now. Oh, we have a middle class. But is the middle class out of debt? No. They're in debt up to their eyeballs. Everybody knows that. Everything from their big screen TV to their automobiles, to their furniture, to their homes, they are buried in debt. And couple that with the fact that the nation, the U.S. Treasury, is in debt to record levels. I mean, we're in debt to record levels. If you read the news this last week, you saw that India was downgraded to triple B. Now, if you know anything about bond ratings, it is your creditworthiness. It's not just how you pay your bills on time. It compares your debt to your gross domestic product. So when you have a country that is 59% in debt, they lower your credit rating because the risk of default is so high. AAA is the best. Double A, and then single A, and then triple B. Well, India has been downgraded to a triple B. And here's the danger with that. You know that the United States was recently downgraded from its triple A to double A. That was not just political. That was the economic performance of the country. Not necessarily its ability to pay its debt or pay its bills on time, but its level of debt compared to its level of earnings. Our earnings have grown by a paltry 2.2%, but our debt has grown by a whopping 30%. It's a very, very big danger signal. It's sort of like what happens to a college student when they get their first credit card. At first, you know, it's a meal here, it's a gas tank there, and then by the time they get a couple hundred dollars in debt, hey, let's go to Florida. Next thing you know, the card's maxed out. They're making minimum payments on the card at 29 to 30% interest, and the debt's going nowhere. You could make minimum payments for 50 years on a credit card and never pay it off. That's the whole idea. Well, we're making interest payments only on our debt, and it's continuing to rise. Why? Because the nation is spending more money than it's taking in. Now, there's always the idea that, well, don't worry about it. You know, we have 300 million people now, and pretty soon we're going to have 350, and they're all going to be working, and we're going to increase our ability to earn. The financial community isn't buying it, and I'm not buying it either, and neither should you. The point is, the nation has gotten to the point where it's spending more money than it's taking in, and it's at the danger point. And so Standard & Poor's decided to downgrade the United States of America to double A. Now, here is where this really gets tricky. Each state has its own bond rating. North Carolina, AAA. There is a rule that no state can have a bond rating more than one step better than the nation in which that state resides. That means that when the United States of America, the faith and credit of America, is downgraded to single A, no state can hold a triple A bond rating. You know what that means? Even states like North Carolina that pay their bills on time, that have a low debt ratio, that have a great reputation for letting bonds and paying them off, They invest in low-risk projects, industrial parks, schools, utilities, things that generate revenue and pay off the debt. They have a great reputation for doing it. But because rules are what they are, North Carolina is going to have its bond rating downgraded to AA. That means that the rate of interest for those bonds increases. In other words, the state cannot use them for incentives like they used to use them. They will be forcibly downgraded because the United States of America is downgraded. And this becomes a dark and dismal spiral. Because if these bonds on a state level cannot be approved, the state cannot underwrite loans to projects that need to be built. Schools, hospitals, roads, bridges, dams, things that states build. The federal government is starting to pull the state governments down the drain with them. So, we're fundamentally, and I mean fundamentally like the very basic rules of good business, doing the wrong thing. I'm not going to blame it on any political party because it's not their fault. No, it's not the fault of the White House. No, it isn't even the fault of Congress directly. And it's not the fault of the Senate. You see, there's another government that's operating inside our government. And no, it's not the big shadow government and all that. It's simple. It's so simple to understand. I call it the agency government. Agency-government. That's what it is. In 1932, Roosevelt paved the way for federal agencies, departments, bureaus, administrations to do for us, the states, what we used to do for ourselves. And of course, none of these agencies have gotten smaller. They've all gotten larger. And with large organizations comes enormous budgets and enormous overhead and enormous corruption. You've seen it already. You've seen it. All you have to do is watch the news. Any news channel will do. Or read any paper. Almost any paper will do. And you will see government agency after government agency after government agency. Lately in the news, I can recall recently the GSA, General Services Administration. What did they do? They went to Vegas. Not just a little to Vegas. They went a lot to Vegas. 300 people went through $822,000 in 3 days. it was a party. Yeah, absolutely. You're right. $146,000 in alcohol. Figure it out, people. That's a hangover that doesn't quit. That's a hangover they make movies about. That's where you don't wake up on the roof, you wake up on the floor. Fortunately for us, the American people, somebody snapped a few iPhone pictures and they leaked out. And boy, did the poop hit the fan. Well, not as bad as what you might think. They didn't hand out 300 pink slips. Nope. They handed out one. One. Just the administrator. Just the secretary of that agency. So, what's wrong with this picture? Oh, well, you know, as each one of them took the microphone and, Congressman Issa or someone else would say, would you please state your name for the record? On advice of my counsel, I've been advised to respectfully decline to answer on the grounds that the answer may incriminate me. You mean you can't tell us your name, right? Is that what you're telling us? On the advice of my attorney, blah, 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 blah. You'd think they were organized crime up there, trying to exercise their Fifth Amendment right. You got no witnesses, you got no proof, and I ain't saying nothing about nothing. That's your government. That's the agency government that you have working for you in Washington. That's the agency that helps people do business with the government. $822,000, my friends, is just the tip of the iceberg. Oh, yeah, there's a whole bunch more than that below the surface. And guess what Congress can do about it? Absolutely nothing. Regulations are in place that actually prevent Congress from even speaking to them. Oh, you can haul them in, but they don't have to say anything. There's no rule that says a government employee has to answer any questions, and you can't fire them because they're in a union. There's nothing anybody can do about it, not without a constitutional amendment. So, if you want to do some great reading, Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty, is now live on Kindle, live on Nook, and tomorrow it is going to go live on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I was going to make it go live a couple of weeks ago. I had a couple of edits to make. I wanted to get the audio book done. It's been recorded. It's being edited. So the audio book's going to be live, and the book is going to go live this week. So your wait is over. You need to read this book because what I just discussed with you in the last 20 minutes is nothing compared to what you're going to learn in that book, and it's all factual. Everything that's happening right now is current in that book, and you're going to learn things you absolutely did not know. Our phone number here, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. If you want to get out and about, we have a wonderful conference line that you can call into, 760-569-7676. And you can dial 192-919-pound, and you can listen while you're out on your phone. And if you have an Android phone, you can go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the Android app, and you can download that to your phone, and you can listen to the program live on your phone. And we're going to be upgrading that app here very soon so that while you're listening on your phone through your iPhone X Squared Radio app, if you really get inspired, which I hope you do tonight, you can actually click the button on the app on your phone, and it will dial the studio straight from that. You don't even have to hang up and redial. It will do it for you. Now, that's pretty cool. That's technology working for us. Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty. You can have it in your hands. If you read electronically, Kindle or Nook, it is ready to go. AlienatedNation.com. AlienatedNation.com. Astronomers have found a new planet capable of supporting life. Oh, yeah. Hang on one moment. A little bit of grapefruit juice. Wonderful. Organically grown grapefruit juice. Awesome. They found a new planet capable of supporting life, and it ain't in the neighborhood. It is the Holy Grail, a planet capable of supporting life outside our solar system. The planet lies in what they describe as a habitable zone, neither too near its sun to dry out or too far away, which freezes it. And the discovery could help answer the question of whether we are alone in the universe, which has been plaguing astronomers and alien fanatics for years, decades, millennia. Just interesting to answer the question. Scientists found the planet, and we don't know what the inhabitants of this planet call it, but we call it Gliese 667 CC, orbiting around a red dwarf star, 22 light years away from Earth. That's really not in the neighborhood, but 22 years is not that far away. And not that I would want to make the trip. I think by the time we got there, I couldn't get off the ship. We got to figure out a way to fold space or ourselves or go into suspended animation. But, I mean, if we launched a ship, got it up to what we call speed, which is somewhere around 0.6, 0.7 light speed, you know, you're still talking about 32, 33 years to get there. That's a ways out there. We have to learn how to travel faster than that. But here's the interesting thing. Red dwarf stars are the most common stars in the neighborhood of the sun, usually hosting planets called gas giants, which are not composed of rock matter. Reanalyzing data from the European Southern Observatory, the astronomers found Gliese 667 cc is a solid planet with roughly 4.5 times the mass of Earth. That could get a little bit hard if you're going to walk around on it. You know, I weigh about 0.1 metric tons. And if I increase that to 4 times, I would weigh about 0.4 metric tons, which would be pretty hard on the old tennis shoes. The University of Göttingen and University of California scientists have calculated the planet receives 10% less light from its red dwarf star than the Earth gets from the sun. As the light is in the infrared area, the planet still receives nearly the same amount of energy as Earth, meaning water could be liquid and surface temperatures could be similar to ours. Not much UV coming off of it or visible light, so you might have to have infrared goggles to be able to see anything. Astronomers are hailing the planet as the holy grail of discoveries, as 20 years ago scientists were still arguing about the existence of planets beyond our solar system. Yes, 20 years ago, we knew everything. We were the center of the universe. We were exceedingly rare. Not many planets out there orbiting around suns. Well, the one thing that we didn't know 20 years ago is that planets don't really put off light. We used a perturbation theory to find planets. That's the wobble that stars exhibit as planets orbit around them. It's kind of a, you know, as a planet orbits around a sun, it tugs on the sun. We're able to measure that wobble, tell how fast it wobbles, how much it wobbles, and from that we can calculate the size of the planet going around that sun. If you really get lucky, the planet will cross the face of that star, and it will inhibit some of the light of that star, and you can really make a close analysis of it. But since the Kepler mission has been launched and we have other methods, the discovery of the first extrasolar planet in 1995, astronomers have confirmed the existence of more than 760 planets beyond the solar system, with only 4 believed to be in a habitable zone. We're still pretty darn rare. One of the most successful tools of planet hunters is the high-accuracy radio planetary searcher, also known as HARPS, not to be confused with HARP. This is a telescope which measures the radial velocity of a star. Scientists using this telescope analyze the small wobbles in a star motion caused by the gravitational response of a planet. It works okay. You know, a few hundred planets have been found with it, but we already know, based on the mass of a planet and its orbit around the sun, how far away from that sun it is. The next thing to do is to measure the intensity of that sun, do some calculations, and figure out whether the entire thing is a big steam ball or whether it's a frozen block of ice. Currently, they can detect planets which are 3 to 5 times the mass of Earth. But in the future, they could detect planets which are smaller than twice the mass of Earth. Earth is really, really hard to find using our technology from way out there somewhere. Stephen Vogt, an astronomer from the University of California, said, "It is the holy grail of exoplanet research to find a planet orbiting around a star at the right distance so it's not too close where it could lose all its water and not too far where it could freeze. There may still be a planet that's just like Earth out there. We just haven't found it. We haven't found it because we haven't found the star. If we have found the star, we haven't been able to measure it. So there are lots and lots of stars and only one telescope, and it takes time to get these kinds of measurements. So the problem is, it's just over the horizon for us. I predict, I have nothing to base this on, except for statistics and probability, that a planet much like Earth will be found in the next 5 years or less, and it won't be that far away. It just will be in an area that we have not looked before. Guillaume Anglada Escudé of University Yttingen, Germany, said, with the advent of new generation of instruments, researchers will be able to survey many dwarf stars for similar planets and eventually look for spectroscopic signatures of life in one of these worlds. That's the kind of thing that we're looking for. That's, you know, one of the things that we have to come to terms with after we find a planet out there is, what do we do with it? I mean, it's nice to know, but does it really mean anything? Is it really going to change anything for us? Answer, yes, it could. Earth is perhaps far too small and fragile a basket in which the human race can keep all of its eggs, or should keep all of its eggs, so to speak. And the other thing is, you know, red dwarfs, although they are nice, it's nice to have a yellow sun. It's nice to have a main sequence sun star that can put out the right wavelengths of light, generate photosynthesis, which can support through photosynthetic generation of sugars and fats and other things, other life forms, things that eat plants, and then animals that eat animals and so forth. That's what we would like to see. Infrared is a little bit skinny for photosynthesis. It can be done, but it's a little skinny. We need light. And speaking of light, there was a special that was out on television, and it was about literally living on light. The documentary film, In the Beginning There Was Light, recently was analyzed on television, and I saw the piece on it, and of course, I know that people can't live on light. Hang on, one more sip here. Not directly, anyway. I mean, light provides the photosynthesis to make the fruit of the tree, whether it's an apple or an orange or a zucchini. And then we eat that food, the fruit of that vine or that branch or that legume or root system, and we survive based on it. Or we eat the animal that eats the corn or the grass, and we get the protein that way. So in a sense, yeah, we're living on light because the sun is the source of all life on this planet. But directly is what this documentary was talking about. It claimed that there was some guru, I'll read you part of the article, a Swiss woman dies after attempting to live on sunlight. Woman gave up food and water on a spiritual journey. This is an Associated Press article. The Swiss newspaper, Tages-Anzeiger, reports that a woman starved to death after embarking on a spiritual diet that required her to stop eating or drinking and live off sunlight alone. Lady, we call that dehydration. Yeah, we do it to fruit and beef jerky. The Zurich newspaper reported Wednesday that the unnamed Swiss woman in her 50s decided to follow the radical fast in 2010. After viewing an Austrian documentary about an Indian guru who claims to have lived this way for 70 years. Of course, somebody caught him at a Golden Corral chugging chicken wings down his neck, but he claimed he hadn't eaten in 70 years. Okay. Well, Tages Anziger says there have been similar cases of self-starvation in Germany, Britain, and Australia. There are prosecutors going after this, trying to figure out what happened to this woman. They confirmed Wednesday that the woman died in January of 2011 in the town of Wurfhalden in eastern Switzerland. And basically the way this system works is you pick the very early morning or the very late afternoon, not direct sunlight in the middle of the day, or you will be etching a peacock on your retina. And you stare at the sun or close your eyes and face the sun. Nice, warm, feels good, especially on a cool morning or a cool afternoon in Switzerland. But somebody forgot to tell this woman that we don't have any chlorophyll in our system. We don't live on photosynthesis. In fact, ultraviolet radiation dimerizes, a more word you could understand. It hammers the heck out of DNA, okay? dimerization occurs when a photon of ultraviolet light strikes a free radical in a protein or a molecule. And there are free radicals. Free radicals, an extra electron. It bounces that electron out of that system, creating a reaction where the two pieces that are joined at that free radical can actually become products. That is to say, you've created a reaction. By adding the photon to it, you have split the molecule in two, which is called dimerization. Now, sometimes, as you sputter that electron out, another electron will come in, so it will repair itself. And that does happen. In fact, it happens most of the time. But a significant amount of the time, the dimerization never fixes itself, and so the molecule comes apart. It comes apart right where that free radical kind of stitches them together. And guess what? It stops being a protein. It stops being an enzyme. And when that occurs, it is no longer useful to the body, and it is summarily surrounded by white blood cells and ejected from the body. In other words, if you're exposed to ultraviolet radiation from the sun directly for a long period of time, your white blood cells will kill you. It's deadly. Now, that doesn't mean you can't go out and work in the yard. You can't work your entire life in the sun with your shirt off. That's fine. But you're going to pay the price. You're going to pay the price in skin cancer, in other kinds of dermatological problems, or physiological problems because of overexposure to ultraviolet radiation, and also cosmic radiation. It ain't a whole lot, generally speaking, but when the sun's very active or the galaxy's very active, you can even be exposed to that. Take this home with you. Most Americans, I'd say 90% of Americans, only spend about 15% of their time outdoors. That's it. The other 85% of the time, we are inside. No photons striking the skin. Some bouncing off things out our window. But generally speaking, we are inside most of the time. We're not exposed to our sun. Not to that extent. We're not built for that. So that's why this Swiss woman died. Don't try this at home, okay? Don't go out there and listen to these crazies that you can stare into the sun and somehow it will go in past the optic nerve and it will hit the pineal gland and your pineal gland will secrete this stuff that you can live on. It ain't happening, okay? Leastways, you don't start doing it at age 50-something and think about turning it around. I don't even want to imagine what a human would look like after 70 years of living in the sun, living off the sun. I think you would look a little bit like a piece of beef jerky with pants. All right. The House of Representatives has approved a cybersecurity bill over the president's threat of a veto. This is Mr. Pete Kasperwitz's story, and I think he did a good job on it, but I also think we missed the point here. The House on Thursday of this last week approved a controversial cybersecurity legislation that the Obama administration has threatened to veto. Members approved the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, also known as CISPA, or CISPA, it's probably more like it, H.R. 3523, in a 248-168 vote that split both parties somewhat. The bill was supported by 42 Democrats, while 28 Republicans opposed it. The House approved the bill after making a number of changes aimed at limiting the way the government could use the information that companies provide. CISPA would make it easier for companies to share information with the government about the threats facing their networks. Right now, businesses don't want to do that because it's sort of like letting the camel's nose into the tent. If a business says, hey, look, we've really had some strange activity on our company server lately. We have a lot of emails. We have a lot of inquiries coming in, and they're written in Chinese. We don't really understand them. And we think that somebody's accessing our blueprints or our banking information or this or that. Well, as soon as you open that up to the government has the power to come in and literally take over your whole system. And talk about airing your dirty laundry. They're going to see it all. And so businesses have been very skittish. It's sort of like calling up the IRS and saying, listen, I've had a hard time balancing my checkbook lately. Could you come in and kind of help me figure out what I'm doing wrong? Uh-huh. So if the IRS came in and said, so Fritz, listen, we were going through your debits and credits here, and we noticed where you got about $70,000 in real income you're not claiming. And I think we need to probably go back a few years and do an audit. You see what I'm saying? A business is not going to come across. They're not going to be really overjoyed about this. So that's what CISPA could help do. The intelligence community has the ability to detect these cyber threats, these malicious codes and viruses, before they are able to attack our networks, said Intelligence Committee Ranking Member Dutch Ruppersberger, Democrat from Maryland. But right now, federal law prohibits our intelligence community from sharing the classified cyber threat with the companies that will protect us, that control the network, the AT&Ts, the Verizons, the Comcasts, you know, those groups. We have the ability to give them the information to protect us, but yet we have to pass a law to do that. Well, the bill enjoyed strong bipartisan support before the administration issued a veto threat and sided with privacy advocates who argued the bill does not do enough to protect consumers' private information. The White House also wants regulatory mandates for critical infrastructure providers, which are not contained in CISPA. Ruppersberger said earlier Thursday that Obama's veto threat of his bill was like a kick in the solar plexus. It also seemed to have the effect of peeling Democrats off the bill, as several Democrats took up Obama's arguments during the floor debate. In an effort to foster information sharing, this bill would erode the privacy protections of every single American using the Internet, said Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat from Mississippi. It would create a Wild West of information sharing, where any certified business can share with any government agency who can then use the information for any national security purpose and grant the business immunity from virtually any liability. That sounds good to me, Benny. I don't know. Representative Jared Polis, Democrat from Colorado, added that the bill is an unprecedented sweeping piece of legislation that would waive every single privacy law ever enacted in the name of cybersecurity. Republicans did allow several amendments to be considered that narrowed the scope of the bill, including proposals from members of both parties. One from Representative Ben Quayle, that was a Republican from Arizona, would allow the government to use the information it collects only for five purposes, only five, all related to protecting people and prosecuting crimes. Others would prohibit the government from using certain electronic data as it works to fight cyber threats, narrow the definition of what information can be shared, and encourage the government to create procedures to protect privacy. Even before those amendments, supporters argued that the bill has enough safeguards in it to ensure the privacy of consumer data. That's my response. The bill includes significant safeguards to protect personal and private information. It significantly limits the federal government's use of that information that the private companies voluntarily provide, including the government's authority to search data. The bill is one of four cybersecurity bills the House is expected to consider this week. It affects us because some of those cybersecurity threats occur on the Internet as they're accessing archives and transferring data back and forth between companies. So it sort of lays the groundwork to do some phishing using specialized engines that will get into your database, your hard drive even, and assess the threat. To whom? That's a good question. To a political party, maybe? Sound a little bit like Electric Watergate? Yeah, hold on. So you have one party looking at another party, or one political faction looking at another political faction. Oh, we're not going to use the data for anything. Uh-huh. Well, that's just my ideas. I think it could get out of hand in a real hurry. If you have any thoughts on it, any ideas about this, if you're in a high-tech world or in the information transfer storage world, I'd like to hear from you, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Don't forget about our Android app at xsquaredradio.com. You can download that to your phone, and all you have to do is click on it, and boom, you're right into BBS Radio Live, Channel 2. Very soon, we're going to upgrade that app to have an extra button so that while you're listening to the program, if you feel so inspired to call in, all you have to do is click the app, and it'll dial the studio, and you'll be in talking to me or to one of the other hosts if you should happen to call in at another time. A couple other things before we round out this hour. If you really want to see what's going to happen with 2012, you might as well go to Ground Zero. Don't be out here hugging your armchair, you know, watching the ball fall in December 31st, 2012. I want you to be with me at Chichen Itza in Mexico from the 13th to the 21st of December. I promise to have you home by Christmas. But this is 8 days you're never going to forget, because we have world-class speakers speaking at Chichen Itza in a wonderful venue. You're going to be all over the ruins. You're going to be listening to speakers from all over the world. Maureen St. Germain, Braden, myself, others. Excellent, excellent, excellent content. And you're going to be at Ground Zero for this whole 2012 thing. You'll be able to tell stories to your friends nobody else is going to be able to tell. You'll have photographs from right there. And how do you do that? It is so simple. All you have to do is go to xsquaredradio.com and click on the bright orange Maya 2012 banner. You click on that, you're going to go right in from our website, and all you have to do is click on register now. Now, you don't have to pay all the money now. Make a deposit, get yourself committed, see yourself there, and join me at Chichen Itza from December 13th to December 21st. Why hang out where it's cold and freezing and raining? Be down there with us. It's going to be warm. It's going to be awesome. And it's going to be amazingly inspirational. Maya 2012. Don't forget about it. If you don't have a passport, if you don't like flying, no worries, mate. All you have to do is click on the blue banner at xsquaredradio.com. No, it's not like taking the blue pill or the red pill. This is the Pythagoras Conference. It's in October of this year, and it is at a resort in southern Indiana. Awesome place. 50 speakers from around the globe are going to be there in the first Midwest conference in our genre, in this New Age genre. Lots of new energy stuff, lots of exopolitics stuff, lots of space exploration, human consciousness, all kinds of neat subjects. It's shorter. It's only 3-4 days. It's Midwest. You can drive to it. It's affordable. And if you click on that blue banner, guess what? You get $100 off. We've given it all to you now. You have no excuses. You can round out 2012 with an awesome, awesome, life-changing conference schedule. Check it out. We'll be back right after this break. Take a quick break. Drink a little bit more grapefruit juice here. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming right after this.
Yeah.
Sportsradio. We're so glad you're here with us tonight. We're coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. By the way, one of my great listeners out there has told me that the Maya 2012 banners, there are two of them on the website, one's large and one's small. Evidently, the link behind the large one, not working. Click on the small one. There's two banners there because I want you to see all the detail there. And I'll have to get on my pesky webmaster. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's me. Okay, I'm fired. click on the small one. The link works just fine. Check it out. I would love to see you all there, especially my my close friends out there. Can't think of any place I'd rather be on that day, and I can't think of anybody better to be with than you guys. So, you know, we are a very high-tech nation. We make our energy from splitting atoms. We use it kind of in a low-tech way, though, I'm sorry to say. We take the heat that comes from the reaction and we boil it, okay? We make steam out of it, superheated steam, and we shoot the steam at a turbine and we spin the turbine and we generate electricity. I know, it's kind of old school, isn't it? It's sort of a little bit like shoveling coal into the boiler in the front of the train, getting the water really, really hot, but not letting it out. Forcing it through a tiny little jet into a piston, which forces the piston to shove to its lowest possible place. The valve shuts off the steam. The momentum of the rail ejects the steam out of the cylinder after all the power is gleaned from it. The train rolls forward, gathering momentum to push the piston to its compressed point again. The valve opens again, forces steam into the chamber, and the piston then expands again, giving one more kick to the train's wheels. The old steam engine. We're still doing it the same way. It's not like a hydroelectric dam where we let water fall according to gravity at 32 feet per second per second, jam it into a nice tight tube that's a very low drag, and turn giant water wheels making electricity. Some of these are really cool. I went down to the motor shop the other day. I should have taken some pictures and posted them. These are about 12 feet across, these generator armatures. And they were in the motor shop getting their coils checked. Coils do go out from time to time. They catch a spike or whatever, burn through the wire, burn through the insulation. You want to keep those things in good working order. Each one of those generates about 2 megawatts, and you'll have 10 or 12 of them on a dam. And so hydroelectric power, also just spinning turbines. But that's how we do it. We're pretty high-tech, pretty advanced in splitting the atom and making electricity the clean way. Of course, the atomic waste is not something to laugh at. Those fuel rods that keep the radioactive decay under check by absorbing all the neutrons, sort of like scooping up half the ping pong balls out of the mousetrap reactor. They get saturated with neutrons, and that stuff is radioactive for about 12,500 years, so that stuff has to be buried in a salt mine somewhere while it goes through that. However, as high-tech as all this gets, it can be fouled up by the simplest stuff. It's sort of like Mother Nature has something else in mind, you know? It's like, did you ever see the movie Avatar? Can I see a show of hands? Oh, yeah, 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 that's good, that's good. I saw it, I think the second day it was out. Had to brave a blizzard to get there. Saw it in 3D my first time. Sorry, I was just enjoying a little reverence there. It was amazing. It was a story. It was a visual experience. Story was a little old, you know, been done before, cowboys and Indians kind of thing. But the amazing animation was phenomenal. What you noticed in that movie is that Ewa, who is the deity of Pandora, was sort of this life force consciousness that throbbed or pulsated from the planet through all living things, because after all living things consumed the water and the energy of the planet, and thus were entangled with the planet, and thus could communicate back and forth with all the consciousness that ever existed on that planet. But when it came time to fight the final war against the techno mercenaries that came from Earth to harvest the unobtainium, it wasn't a high-tech response that defeated them. It was Mother Nature. And that's why this story is so fascinating. Because while the nuclear power plant is rolling along, minding its own business in Diablo Canyon, Mother Nature had another idea. No, it wasn't an earthquake. It wasn't anything like that. It was a jellyfish. A jellyfish-like organism shut down the Diablo Canyon, California power plant. Workers of the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant received a very slimy surprise this week when they discovered hordes of jellyfish-like creatures clinging to the structure, leading to the shutdown of the plant. One of the things that nuclear power plants do, and if you've ever gone bonita fishing, you'll know all about this. Bonita are in the tuna family. They're very fast, not too bad eating, a whole lot of fun to catch. Where do you catch them? You catch them near the spillway of the power plant, because the power plant uses seawater in their heat exchanger to cool the water that cools the reactor. So it eventually, especially if they're running at a good power level in the summertime, running all those air conditioners, you know, it heats up the water in the bay, just a few degrees. But the bonita love it. And evidently, these jellyfish-like organisms love it too. The organisms, called salp, are small sea creatures with a consistency similar to a jellyfish. The influx of salp was discovered as part of the plant's routine monitoring system, according to Tom Cuddy, the senior manager of external and nuclear communications for the plant's operator, Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E. He says, when they made the conservative decision to ramp down the affected unit to 20% and continue to monitor the situation, when the problem continued, we made another conservative decision that it would be safest to curtail the power of the unit. In other words, they shut it off. The salp were clogging the traveling screens in the intake structure, which are meant to keep marine life out and keep the unit cool. But as you know, jellyfish have a way of kind of squeezing through the orifices. And when they do, especially if they don't make it through, they shut off the screens. And so the flow of water cannot go through. If you've ever had a strainer situation with orange juice, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. If you're not one of those people that likes the pulp in their orange juice, you pour your squeezed orange juice through a strainer. Well, the pulp blocks the screen of the strainer, and so the orange juice will fill up the strainer and not flow through to your waiting breakfast glass. You could do two things. You can say, to heck with it, I'm drinking the pulp, which is what I do. Or you can take a spoon and you can rub it back and forth and get the pulp out of the way and let the orange juice go through. Evidently, they didn't have any spoons, so they had to shut the plant down. Safety is the highest priority, Cuddy said. We will not restart the unit until the salp moves on and conditions improve. No priority is more important than the safe operation of our facility. The plant consists of two units. Unit 1 was shut down previously because of refueling and maintenance work and will not be functional for several weeks. Now that Unit 2 has been shut down because of the influx of salp, the plant has ceased all production. Even with the Diablo Canyon plant out of commission, PG&E has pledged to continue production using other sources of power so that customers are unaffected by the closure. We've had Salp cling to the intake structure before, but nothing to this extent, Cuddy said. The plant strategy? Simply wait until the Salp move on and resume production once the filters are clear. Makes sense to me. So that's what Mother Nature had in mind for the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. Lights out. Now, most of us out there surf the web. You're doing it tonight while you're listening to this program, while you're working on your favorite project on Monday morning, or while you're listening live, which we hope you are. By the way, if you want to join us tonight and give my voice a little rest, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. I got a notice yesterday or the day before from my good friend Jonathan Elinoff. He's been on the program a couple of times. Jonathan is one of the, I'm not going to say a conspiracy theorist. He is more like a conspiracy student. He studies, vets the facts very carefully, and then makes his revelations, and I don't mean a revelation like at the end of the Bible. I mean he reveals stuff to us so that we can stay aware of it. Now, I like his website, and I think Jonathan treats information very intelligently and doesn't get all, you know, excited or bent out of shape about it, and thus spreads, you know, spreading the fear about it. Jonathan does a very intelligent treatment of the information. Now, that being said, those about whom he has revealed the information are not too happy about it, to say the least. And so Jonathan has decided not to call it quits, but to realize that he can no longer be effective in that genre. And so he is going to resume his filmmaking career, and he's also going to be going in a different direction. I could say maturity is the better part of valor, but that's not really the case with Jonathan because he never really got out there. But he did find out information that others didn't find out and consequently got some law enforcement arrested, got some very, very good prosecutions in place, which cleaned up a lot of corruption, especially in his local area. Well, you know, you can't do that for too long, but what you start noticing little bright red dots on the outside of your clothing at night. So Jonathan has decided to live to fight another day. And we commend him on all the great work that he's done and all the great integrity that he brought to that business of looking at all the dark and terrible things that go on out there and keeping us safe. So congratulations, Jonathan, on moving on your new venue, and we will support you no matter what you do out there. That being said, you know, the claims that we don't live in a very good neighborhood are not completely unfounded. Intruders from China hacked into computers. Maybe mine. Maybe that's why my screen went dark. If you've ever been hacked by a Chinese hacker, give me a call, 888-429-5471. I want to know what it feels like so that I know when it comes. But intruders from China hacked into computers that belong to the government. Oh, yeah. And they stole the blueprints for America's new joint strike fighter planes, the F-35 and the F-22. Oh, yeah. According to the chairman of the House Homeland Security Subcommittee on Oversight, Investigations, and Management. I'm just waiting. I'm watching my BS detector here. I just want to see if it goes up or not. You know, because the one thing that people down at Wars R Us also known as Homeland Security Subcommittee on Oversight, Investigations, and Management. War's RS is better. It just sticks better. If you want to know more about it, you really want to know what's going on and how crazy these people can get, pick up my new book, Alienated Nation, and read it. Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty. It's at alienatednation.com. I'm going to put a link at X Squared Radio, too, so you can find it easier. I've just gotten behind, you know, my day job and everything. Daddy's got to eat every day. You know how it goes. So the folks down at Wars R Us can deal with almost anything. They can deal with every contingency you could imagine. I mean, if the Russians attacked Florida and landed on the beach wearing rubber gum boots, everything has already been figured out by a team of experts. They already know what to do. Except for one thing. You know, it's a terrible thing when the Army and the Marines and the Air Force and the Navy are all dressed up and have nobody to kill. That's what they do. They kill people and break things. That's what they're hired to do. That's what they're good at. That's what they're armed to do. And although it's never stopped them before, because you don't really have to have somebody to fight, you just have to have the weapon. Just give us the weapon. We'll find a way to use it. So the folks down at Wars R Us can deal with war, but they can't deal with no war. That's the thing. They don't know how to deal with peace, the absence of war. And so what you have is a perception of threat that intruders from China, China's a big country. You know, they could be private. They could be kids. They could be folks down at an internet cafe having a blast one night. You're painting with a broad brush, and you're making it sound nefarious, like we need to posture ourselves against an entire country. Intruders from China hacked into computers and stole the blueprints for America's new joint strike fighter planes. What were those blueprints doing in your email? Don't you have those in a computer that's like not plugged into anything? Do you have to share everything on the internet? I think not. I think that I don't believe this report. But Representative Michael McCaul, a Republican from Texas, made the statement during a Tuesday hearing on cybersecurity. I've been dealing with this issue for a long time, he said. But I think it's important that the American people, who most of them don't understand this issue, have a better idea of what is at risk. You know, when I look at the theft of intellectual property to the tune of $1 trillion, that's a serious economic issue for the United States. When I look at countries like China, who have stolen our Joint Strike Fighters, F-35 and F-22s, stolen those blueprints so they can manufacture those planes and then guard against those planes. China has created citizen hacker groups engaged in cyber espionage, established cyber war military units, and laced the U.S. infrastructure with logic bombs. It's not only the government to do so, he added. Make no mistake, America is under attack by digital bombs, McCaul said. There are several things the American public should understand about these attacks. They are real, stealth, and persistent, and can devastate our nation. They occur at the speed of light. They are global and could come from anywhere on the earth. They penetrate traditional defenses, he continued. So who is conducting these attacks and why? An October 2011 report to Congress on Foreign Economic Collection and Industrial Espionage states it is part of China and Russia's national policy to identify and steal sensitive technology which they need for their development. Well, he's right. He's right. How do I know this? By personal experience. designs that I personally, Brooks Agnew, made. I showed the Chinese, and they built them without my permission. And they didn't pay me anything for them. And those products are now being built and sold and driven by their customers. So they're right. They're not defending against what I designed, but they certainly benefited from many years of gleaning and learning and designing this information for myself, and they just took it. Thank you very much. Well, he goes on to say, when you look at China and Russia, who have hacked into every federal agency in the federal government, including the Pentagon, you know, we talk about the analogy agents of a foreign power. Wow, this doesn't make sense. You know, we talk about the analogy agents of a foreign power, call it paper files, walking out with classified or non-classified information. It would be all over the papers. But yet, in the virtual world, that's what's happening. And no one seems to know or really pay attention to it. And then the final piece. You know, there's the espionage, the stealing of military secrets, satellite technology, rocket technology out of NASA. It's prevalent. It's everywhere. The Texas Republican, a former federal prosecutor, reiterated his commitments on Wednesday on C-SPAN's Washington Journal program. Well, you know, guys, look, it's very simple. Go around behind the computer. You'll see a blue wire coming out of the back of the computer. It has an R484 connector on it. It looks like a large phone plug, you know, like a little square plug. Do me a favor. Jerk that sucker out of the socket, okay? When you pull that thing out, you couldn't hack that computer with a double-bladed axe. That's how it's done, folks. Take your computers off the network, especially ones that have sensitive information. Put them on thumb drives and put them in a safe somewhere if you have to have them in soft form. They can't hack a thumb drive. Larry Wartzell, a member of the United States China Economic and Security Review Commission. How would you like to have that on your business card? What do you do, Larry? Oh, I'm a member of the United States China Economic and Security Review Commission. Oh, yeah, far out. Anyway, he told the House Foreign Affairs Committee at a March 28th hearing. I mean, that's kind of like being the deputy assistant director of paper towels. Anyway, a March 28th hearing that a report released by the commission last month had concluded that the People's Liberation Army of China, are they still around? The People's Liberation Army of China has made cyber attacks a cornerstone of its operations. Well, you know, when I graduated, I got my degree in nuclear chemistry from Tennessee Technological University. I decided to go straight through the summers. I was very dedicated because I went back to school at a later age. Most of the young people like to have their weekends off and definitely like to have their summers off to go do whatever it is they do in the summer that's unproductive and completely irresponsible, mostly with their bodies. I decided to stay in school and stay loaded up, 21, 22 hours a semester, double loads in the summer. And I graduated in August, not in December or in May, like most people who would finish a traditional semester. Well, guess who else graduated in August? Every other completely dedicated student in that school. 14,000 students. Not a huge university, but it's certainly a great university in Cookeville, Tennessee. I graduated first in my class. I'll let you know that right up front. I have photographic proof. Alphabetically. I graduated first in my class alphabetically. And when I was up there getting my diploma and shaking the hand of the university president in response to my congratulations for being on the honor roll on the dean's list, I looked back out over the auditorium, which wasn't completely full because, keep in mind, this was a minority of the students that go through summer and graduate at the end of August. Most of them are going to come back in September and go through traditional you know, four-month semesters. As I looked out over the audience, I noticed one thing missing. Caucasians. Everybody in the audience was Chinese or Indian or Japanese. So when it comes to cyber attacks being a cornerstone of Chinese operations, I believe them. Because the sharpest students in the school were the ones that hardly spoke any English. The ones that did speak English would go to the lectures. Well, everybody went to the lectures. But the ones sitting in the back don't understand very much English. What they do understand, or what they see on the board, they write down. And then the one student that does understand English, as soon as the classes are over for that day, they go to the library and he translates all of those lectures into Chinese for them. They then study the translated version overnight and go to the class the next day. So not only are they struggling with the information like physical chemistry or calculus, but they're struggling with the language because not all the concepts translate directly in the language. Verb forms are different, approaches are different, especially colloquialisms or things like that that an instructor might use. Still, even with all that, these students came to the United States with their tuitions completely paid for by their governments, which meant they were the top of the top in that country, sent to America to go to school. No, you're not going there to play golf. You're not going there to get yourself an American wife. You're not there to sow your Asian seeds or to drink yourself into a stupor. You were there to honor our money, and you're going to get smart and get that degree, and you're going to come back. And that's what they did. So I believe them. Now, Wartzell continues, at the same time, the report concludes, during peacetime, computer network exploitation has likely become a cornerstone of PLA and civilian intelligence collection operations supporting national, military, and civilian strategic goals. Listen, when you can't create anything on your own, when you're not a designer, a creator, you don't have that drive. You're a Romulan, okay? Romulan. You know, like The Wrath of Khan. You ever watch The Wrath of Khan, one of the first Star Trek movies out there? In The Wrath of Khan, they're having sort of a dogfight in a space cloud, a star cloud, and they don't really have visible methods of seeing each other because the sensors can't really see where the ships are going. You know, it interferes with the instruments. Even the mighty Spock cannot locate him. But also, Khan cannot locate the Enterprise to fire on it. And one of the things that Kirk realizes is that Romulans cannot think in three dimensions. And so rather than fight in the star cloud like you're on a giant football field, he simply sunk below, out of sight, drifted over to the side, and then rose up through the cloud to a superior position to be able to fight a fire on Khan and his spacecraft, thus defeating him. Well, lots of scientists out there are very bright, very smart. When you show them what to do, when you give them the procedure, when you give them the formulas, things already figured out. Oh, they're good at that. They can copy. They can go into production. They can even make some buffing and polishing, you know, actions to various things and even perhaps make them better. But they can't think of them on their own. If you give them a blank computer and say, design for me an F-35 strategic fighter, they're lost. Can't do it. So they spend the bulk of their energy taking other people's ideas. And then once they have the idea, they can put it into action. They've got unlimited horsepower, unlimited people, unlimited money, because after all, they own our debt. And they can put into operation things that we cannot afford to do. Now, The commission report tells us that China's computer network exploitation activities to support espionage opened rich veins of information that was previously inaccessible or could only be mined in small amounts with controlled human intelligence operations. The commission's 2009 annual report to Congress, citing a Wall Street Journal article, discussed intruders probably operating from China that exfiltrated several terabytes of data related to design and electronic systems of the F-35 Lightning II, one of the most advanced fighter planes under development. In addition, the report noted, Lockheed Martin Corporation, Northrop Grumman Corporation, and British Aerospace and Engineering reportedly all have experienced penetrations from hackers based in China in the past 3 years. They are exactly right. That is exactly what is happening out there. So what do we do about it? I already told you, you have to pull the plug. You've got to yank that blue cord out of the back of the computer. You can't leave it hooked up to the internet, because if you do, they're going to get it there, going to get in there, and they're going to steal your information. That's what's happening. That's what's happening. And the same thing could happen to your business, your company. So be careful. Don't share electronic files with them, because they'll take it and they'll grow with it, and you won't get paid diddly for it. So there's a lot going on out there that you don't know about and that I don't know about, but it is affecting American business. You know, one of the things that happens when you have an economy that has 1.5 billion people in it, we have an economy of 300 million in this country, but half of our population, maybe a little better than half our population, is guess what? No, children. They're children, okay? They're not productive. We only have about 89 million people in the labor system in our country. Doesn't that sound amazing? We have 300 million people in our country and only 89 million are actually drawing a paycheck. Doesn't that seem a little skinny to you? It does to me too. I was thinking the same thing. So with production where it seems to be, how do you possibly pull out of this? How do you make it function? You have to come up with innovation. You have to drive new ideas into the system so that you can continue to grow, because you can't just keep making the same old thing. Unless, of course, you're McDonald's. I mean, Big Macs are just as popular now as they were 20 years ago. But I can guarantee you the process for making Big Macs has changed a lot. It's become much more efficient. The procedures for putting a Big Mac together are much more complex than you think they are. You just bite into it and go, oh, wow, that's really good. I'm really loving it. No, it's not a McDonald's commercial. I'm just telling you. But, you know, you have to think about, wait a minute, 2 all beef patties, lettuce, cheese, special sauce, pickled onions on a sesame seed bun. Does it go on in that order? No, it doesn't. Did you know that the ketchup and mustard go on in a specific order? Do you know why? Because mustard is very oily and ketchup is very watery. And depending on which one you put on first, one soaks into the bun faster than the other. Kind of makes the sandwich soggy. It also tastes differently if you put the ketchup on first and then the mustard, or the mustard on first and then the ketchup. It's true. It's true. Of course, on a Big Mac, it's got special sauce. I'm thinking about a quarter pounder. So everything goes on in a specific order. It takes a certain amount of seconds to assemble that thing. And yes, you can. Yes, you can get a Big Mac in China. Of course you can. But if you go to Kentucky Fried Chicken, you won't like it. No. Well, because they don't cook the same way we cook. I don't care what the procedures say. The fried chicken comes out tasting a little bit like shrimp, okay? And they have a lot of fish on the menu. And they don't really believe in changing the grease like we change the grease here because the market doesn't really care. If it tastes like chicken over there, it really tastes like fish because that's part of their culture. And it isn't part of our culture. We would not eat a chicken breast that tasted like a white fish. And we just wouldn't. But the Chinese don't mind it. So when you go over there, if you ever go over there, you think, oh, hey, there's KFC. Let's run in and get something to eat. You're in for an awakening. But McDonald's is a little different. If you go to Japan, you're going to spend about 550 yen for a Big Mac, which is about $6. And it's going to taste pretty much just like a Big Mac right down here on the corner anywhere in the United States. It's a pretty standard system globally. It's very impressive. Cars are a little different story. Airplanes, a little different story. Honestly, I am not getting in anything that's built in China and flying in the air. Not doing it. Just the quality is not there. Not there. It's not that they're not smart. They are. They're just smart in a different way. They can copy really well. They just can't innovate. So that's just my take on it. Here in this country, we have very, very smart people. Honestly, the smartest people are probably working right now. We have a way of, you know, getting to the, distilling it down to the very best. So the very best never have a problem finding a job. They might be out of work for 2 or 3 or 4 months, but then they're going to go right back to work. But the average worker, the person that sits there and runs a punch press or sews clothes together or, you know, paints a part or either fills or empties an injection mold machine. The average worker is where we have really suffered in this country. Because what mega corporations have done is they have said, wait a minute, I got to pay a guy $12.50 an hour to do this here in this country when I can pay $2.50 an hour in another country. The economy of scale becomes irresistible. It does. You're sitting there right now with your tablet, whether it's a Samsung or whether it's a Panasonic or whether it's an Apple, and a significant portion, if not all of it, was made in China. Why? Why do that? If you're an American company, why make it in China? The simple reason is cost. The Apple iPad sells for around, what, $600? If you would have told the market, anyone in marketing, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, look, we're going to create a new computing device. It's called a tablet, all right? It's called a pad. And it's like a laptop, but it's not, okay? It's just the screen of the laptop. The keyboard, everything is virtual on it. There's no hard drive per se. It's just a digital storage device. There's no floppy disk. There's no USB port. You have to get everything into it through our proprietary cord or through the internet, through a Wi-Fi or through a phone connection. And it's not going to be terrifically difficult to do. But it's going to cost $600. I guarantee you every marketer in this country would have said, are you crazy? How much money do you have? You're going to be throwing it up a horse's rear. Because everybody has a notebook or a laptop or a PC at their house. What do they need a tablet for? We got cell phones we can text on. We got buttons on them and everything. Nope. It's going to be like an iPhone, only better. And not many people had iPhones 4 years ago either. It's going to be a tablet. It's going to be a pad, like an electronic writing pad. And somebody probably said, you know, nice novelty, but it's a niche. Well, go figure. At $600, the Apple iPad changed the way we interface with data. We read magazines and books and surf the web and answer emails and everything all on a digitizer screen now. I have a Bluetooth keyboard for mine because I like punching keys as opposed to the screen all the time. But yeah, I use this stuff all the time. It's bigger than the phone. I get more resolution on it. I can look at the pictures. I can read a magazine. I can surf the internet lightning fast. I can go through my emails in a matter of seconds. It's great. I love it. And so does 500 million other people that own them. Think about it, folks. 500 million people with tablets in a 36-month period at $600 a copy. Those numbers are staggering. Staggering. And it changed an industry. It changed a society. And the parts are made in China. Now, just to give you an idea, how many people work at this plant? It's going to blow your mind. Absolutely blow your mind. We have nothing, nothing, nothing to compare to it in this country. The factory is so large that you don't have time to leave the factory to go eat lunch. It's a migration. So you have to provide meals at this factory. Not only that, the people work 10 and 12 hours a day, not 4 days a week, not 5 days a week, 7 days a week. 7 days a week. That means that they don't have time to go home. You can't move 26,000 people home and then back again in 12 hours to work again. So you have to provide them housing. Now let me get this straight. Let me see if you get this picture. You have a plant with more than 25,000 workers in it. It's a town. We're not talking about 50 acres under roof. No, 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 no. We're talking about 500 acres under roof. Not thousands of square feet. Millions upon millions of square feet. And rows and rows and rows of tables. Tables with small tools. With kanbans. Kanbans are a fixed amount of a small quantity of parts that keep flowing to the table, whether it's screws or a connector or a casing or a ribbon cable or something like that. That's all you do. 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, you put a ribbon cable in. You put a flat battery in. You lay a digitizer screen on top of an adhesive strip. That's what you do. Day after day after day. And it's a good job. It's considered one of the better jobs in China. But you have no time to spend your money. And you don't save money. Why? Because it usually works out that the meals and the place where you stay is part of your paycheck. You don't get to take that home. You don't get to spend that anywhere else. You make just enough money to get through life to the next day. You don't build a savings for nothing. There is no day when, okay, I've got enough money now. I can leave Apple and I can go out on my own. I can go back to farming. I can teach school. I can become an artist or a singer. There's no time for that. There's no going out for chicken wings and beer because you're working 7 days a week. You have 12 hours to have a family life, get some sleep, and grow old. And that's it. That's how that city inside that country works. That's how it flows. We don't have a life like that. We work 40 hours a week, not 120 hours a week. We have a value that we place on one thing more than any other society in this world. What do we place that value on? You over there. That's right. Our spare time, our free time, that's exactly right. That's what we value in this country. If you work in a factory, you don't work for the joy of work. You don't live to work. You work to live. You want to get out on the lake with your jet ski or your sailboat. You want to save up and take that cruise this summer with your mom or your family. If you live in the north, you want to go up north in the summertime to go fishing or hunting. It's our spare time. In fact, our whole economy literally runs on the spare time that we value. Every commercial that you watch on TV, with the exception of Red Wing Boots, okay? Yeah, I love their commercial. Our work is work. Because they make boots for working people. Steel-toed boots, hard-shell boots, leather boots, high-top boots, low-top boots, grippy boots, waterproof boots, grease-proof boots. They make boots for working people. Every other commercial on the web is either how to lose weight, how to become more regular, how to quit drinking, how to have fun this weekend, drinking and partying, where are you going to go skiing, what kind of motorcycle you're going to buy, what kind of sport you're going to play or your kids are going to play. That's not part of the job. That's what we do with our money for ourselves. And we don't have to wait till we're old to do it. We do it on Friday at 5 o'clock. We have every single week 2 days to ourselves. We don't have to work. We can do what we want to do. And hopefully we've made enough money during the 5 days to get us through the 2 days at the end of the week. That's not always the case, I hear. But that's the idea. That's the American dream. Work 40 hours a week. Oh, my goodness. When is the last time I worked 40 hours a week? I would say, oh, man, I have to go back further than that. I would say early 80s. The early 80s is the last time I worked 40 hours a week. I have been working between 75 and 100 hours a week for more than 20 years. But that's why I'm successful. You can't get successful on 40 hours a week. That's just enough to put food on the table, maybe, and make payments on a car. That's about it. Watch TV, watch Gunsmoke, and fall asleep in the easy chair. That's about it. You want to be successful? You need another job on top of that job, another 40-hour-a-week job. And you take the money from your second job, and you put it all in the bank until you get enough money, $50,000, $100,000, $200,000, and then you start a business. And then you become your own boss. And that 40-hour week, that's tossed out the window. There's no more 40-hour week. You're going to be successful. You're going to work a calendar and not a time clock. That's the American dream. That doesn't exist in China. It exists a little bit in India because people in India are really struggling with, I guess you'd call it the American dream. They're struggling with the Indian dream. That is to say, work hard and be smart and you can be successful. And success means that you don't have to work 80 or 90 or 100 hours a week any longer. You've reached the point where the interest on your money, the earnings on your money, the amount of work that your money can do can support you while having to work very little. That's the idea. And lots of Indians are getting there. Because they have a free market society and there's a lot of investment money coming into the country. The rupee is amazingly cheap right now. I think it's 54 or 55 rupees to the dollar. Come on, it doesn't get any better than that. Get over there. Get some work done. However, with other countries, that's a struggle. And with our country, it's a struggle. Somehow we were raised in this idea that we're going to work 40 hours a week and we're going to be successful. No, you're going to work 40 hours a week and you're going to meet your obligations and you're going to grow old and die. You're going to meet all your responsibilities, take a 2-week vacation if you're lucky once a year, celebrate Christmas, Easter, your birthday, etc. And that's it. But you're not going to be successful. Success is when you can live off of the work that your money is doing for you. That's success. You know, Shaq played basketball. And he was rich, absolutely rich. But Shaq's boss, the one that wrote the check, he was wealthy. There's a big difference. That's the difference that we want to try to achieve, I think. Now, what we're doing here in this country, what we struggle with every single day as mortals in this biological transducer that we call the human body, is we are looking for something that gives us that residual income, that gives us that residual break, something that gets us up over the hump so that our money continues to work for us while we're not working. It's what our grandparents try to do. It's what our folks try to do, if you still have folks out there. It's what you're trying to do, and you want to do it in your lifetime. Now, you don't necessarily want to send all that wealth to your grandkids, do you? I don't have any suggestions for that except for a mind change, a mindset change. So in the last hour, I want to talk a little bit about the ability to remember the future, the ability to place an idea, a dream, a function of what you want to do, what you want to be, what you want to have even out there in the future, making it resonate with the future, bringing it back to the past, which is the present, and making it function. Making it functional. And you don't have to steal anybody's idea to do this. This is your own idea. This is your own thing that you make up. Maybe it's not invented yet. Maybe it's not even built yet. But it will be, because you're going to think it into existence. And then you're going to make it happen. It's a very, very fascinating process. Because have you ever seen the movie Next? It was with Nicolas Cage. I don't know what year it came out. It was perhaps half a dozen years ago. I don't know. Nicolas Cage makes so many movies. He's extremely productive when it comes to movies. But the bottom line is that Nicolas Cage plays this character that can see about 2 minutes into the future. And sometimes that's all it takes, just to be able to see 2 minutes into the future. Now, let me see if I can boost my sound just a little bit. I am having a problem on my end. I'm noticing on my amount that's going to the computer. It keeps going down and going up, so I don't know what's going on. I hope you're hearing me clearly out there. I'll make some tweaks during the break. So, basically, he said the future changes just because you looked at it, and it does. It's called the observation effect, and it does affect the way that the future works. Let me just see if I can make a quick, just a tweak here, just a tweak. Hold on just 1 second here. Okay, hang on a second. I'm going to raise my microphone level just a little bit so that you can hear me a little bit better. Hold on a second here, because I'm way, way down here. Just a little bit. Raise it up to right about there. Can you hear me a little better? Yeah, see, there we go. Oh, I don't know why it's doing that. Okay, that should do it. I changed it back up to 24%, so you should be hearing me much better. Ah, it says, oh, yes, we hear you well. All right, we're better now. I don't know why, but my microphone level in the computer changed a little bit, and I just changed it back, so you should be hearing me fine now. Anyway, the future changes just because you looked at it. That's called the observation effect, backed up by physics very, very well. He could see about 2 minutes into the future, so he could make observations on that future and make it happen. That's what we're going to talk about in the next hour. So don't go away. We'll be right back in about, what is it? Looks like 2 minutes and 28 seconds. I might need a little longer break than that. But don't go away. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio right after this.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun, that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
The spice extends life. The spice, expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
All right, Earth Explorers. Welcome back to X-Squared Radio. Hang on a second while I adjust my levels. Trying to get into all the random parameters. That should put us in pretty good shape. Checking really quick with the studio. How does it sound? Just want to make sure we sound okay. All right. Welcome back to X-Squared Radio. So glad to have you here. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast about 74 degrees. Clear skies tonight. By the way, if you should get out tomorrow and look up at the sky, you should notice that Venus is actually visible with the naked eye during daylight. Quite fascinating. It is about a minus 4.7, which is 190 times brighter than a level 1 star. All right, let's talk about the future. Let's talk about what you're going to do with the future. You know, when we talk about time in physics, we become fascinated with the concept, but it's rather elusive in a theoretical sense. That is to say, it is just as far from Charlotte to Atlanta as it is from Atlanta to Charlotte. So mathematically speaking, time is equal, whether we're looking into the future or whether we're looking into the past. But human consciousness is kind of unique in the sense that we can perceive time. Animals and other forms of life have no perception of time. They just go throughout their day without desires, without the ability to discriminate between right and wrong, without the ability to actually grow and mature. Now, you know, rats can get smart enough to make their way through a maze. Monkeys can get smart enough to wash their food from island to island. All that is academic. We figure that out. We know how that works. We can prove it anthropologically and even zoologically. We can study animals and figure things out. But humans are a little different. We have perspective. We can say to ourselves, without anybody's help at all, you know, based on my experience, this is a really bad idea. Or based on my experience, I am really looking forward to that dessert. Because we have a memory, because we have an experience, we have a wisdom that we have gained through a series of mistakes that we have made or that we have read about other people making. For instance, you wouldn't go invest in a Ponzi scheme, would you? Well, I guess you do when you pay your Social Security. But other than that, you don't. You may never have. Why? Well, because you read that Ponzi schemes are a bad idea. You learned from other people's mistakes. You gained wisdom from teachers, mentors, friends, family, or even those that have experienced those bad things and have told you about them, or you witnessed it on TV or read an article or a book. So in that sense, human consciousness has a tendency to grow, to morph, to adapt. Without having to literally get burned, you know that things are hot. And that is unique to the human consciousness. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that our consciousness is that much different than a horse or a monkey or a bird or a fish. But it does mean that in this biological transducer, in this world, in this reality, we are the sentient being, and they are the beasts of earth. They are the schools. They are the flocks. They are the herds in the field. They're the gaggle. They're the brace. We are the independent, walking through the world, afraid of nothing, and able to conquer literally everything, including the sky itself or the deepest oceans. So we have a perspective, or the ability to take a perspective, no matter how simple and uneducated the human being, it is obvious to the most casual observer that there is some innate ability that allows a race of beings who are not the fastest, definitely not the strongest. We have no ability to exist in the elements on our own. We cannot dig in the ground. We don't have nails for fighting or teeth for defending ourselves. And yet we survive, we proliferate, we prosper, in fact, even when conditions are such that you would think that our form of life could not survive at all. For instance, in Arctic conditions or desert conditions, we still survive. Why? Because we learn. We can surmise how to survive in those terrible climates and terrible conditions. And so we survive based on our ability to think, to reason, to desire, and to look into the future and look into, and learn from the past. One of the things that we know about consciousness is that when it observes something, whether it's a chemical reaction or whether it is an event in time, historically or prospectively, by looking into the future, we affect it. How does that happen? Well, it could be argued just based on the fact that any time energy is added to void, you have created space. That is the definition of space. Space is the presence of energy or particles. So once our energy has been put into that void, whether it's a void in time or whether it's a void in outside the universe, we have created space. We have met the definition of space by putting our energy into that system. When we look at the universe itself out from outside the universe, and this is theoretical, but it is nonetheless plausible, and we make the argument, and I'll explain it to you in a moment, and it's effective, and you'll understand it, and you'll know it. I was going to say you'll believe it, but who cares if you believe or not? Belief is... is irrelevant to anything. Only knowledge is what counts. We go outside the universe and look back at the universe and we say, there is a fixed amount of energy in the universe. There's a fixed amount of matter in the universe. And there is a fixed amount of resolution in the universe, and therefore the universe is finite. Big, but finite. However, human consciousness does not appear to be finite, because we could create out of nothing an idea. We can envision things that are not there and that will eventually be there, simply because we had the vision. We had the idea. And so in that respect, it could be argued that perhaps the universe is not infinite, because consciousness cannot be measured with the Planck unit, 10 to the minus 33rd meters. We're talking about not finite resolution. And if that's happening inside the universe, then it's happening outside the universe, which means information is flowing into the universe, information is flowing out of the universe. Is it a net zero? I don't know. It's irrelevant. The point is that consciousness is what has created what we perceive as the universe. You already know, if you listen to this program on a regular basis, that the vast majority, and I'm talking about 94 to 95% of the universe, is imperceptible. That is to say, it's dark matter, dark energy. It's dark because it doesn't show up on the radar. It doesn't show up on the screen. It doesn't show up on the camera lens or on the voltmeter or on the HARPS system, any kind of telescope or instrument that we have. The only thing that we can see is the perturbation, how this great amount of mass, this great amount of energy perturbs the visual universe that we see, the stars, planets, galaxies, clusters, etc. It's the dark matter. It's the massive amount of space, particles or energy, that must be there because the visual part of the universe behaves the way that it does. It's sort of like a duck swimming in a pond. You can't see the pond, but you can see the duck, and you see that the duck is floating and that the duck is waddling its feet and thus moving itself forward. And so you say, oh, the duck must be floating in water, because we see that the duck can push against something out there, which makes itself go forward, and then it floats basically on the level of something. Well, that's what the universe is like. We have a pond. We have an unconscious, not unconscious, we have a subconscious universe against which the conscious universe is contrasted. That's what we perceive as reality. The key word being perceived, because our perception is an observation. The observation sometimes, most of the time, is some kind of perception that we have. It's too hot, it's too cold, it's too hard, it's too easy, it's too black, it's too white, etc. It's good, it's evil, it's good or bad. The perception that we put on it is the energy with which is the energy that is put out into the universe. Now, one of the things that we know about energy, whether we're talking about sound or light, sound really is light, just very low frequency. It's all energy. It's all frequency. One of the things that we know, if we walk into a room or a china closet or a auditorium and we play a musical note loud enough where it's audible, where sound waves are being generated in that air. One of the things that we know from our experience in designing auditoriums and various listening rooms, whether it's for plays, which are typically not amplified, or symphonies, which also are typically not amplified, is that the design of the room has to be conducive to allow that sound to propagate to every seat in the auditorium. It really would do no good at all if you sold seats in an auditorium that somehow, when the average tonal quality of a full orchestra was played, that the standing waves were such that they never reached this corner of the room. So literally, you could be sitting in this corner and a violin could be playing up front and you couldn't hear it because the room is such that that vibration can't get out there to resonate with the air molecules and reach your ear. If you've ever been in a recording studio, it's kind of like that. The walls have these kind of foam egg cartons on it. There's carpet on the floor and carpet on the ceiling. Why? Because you're trying to absorb all those sounds after they leave the musical instrument and after they get past the microphone. Because you don't want sound bouncing off a window or a door or a tile floor or something like that back into the microphone. It creates a dissident resonation with the music, and you don't get full, clean power going into that microphone because of the extraneous sound that's coming later after the note is played into the microphone. And so you create all the sound dampening ability in this studio, which some studios can be rather large. They can hold 30 or 40 people or 50 or 100 people, and some are rather small, like a little sound booth where it holds one person and a microphone and maybe a sheet of music or words. Well, one thing that you notice is if you have two people in that kind of situation, you try to talk to one another, you can't hear a word they say. You see their mouth moving, but you don't hear any words. Why? Because when the words come out of the mouth, they're immediately absorbed by all the material around it. In other words, nothing resonates with the voice, and so it never reaches your ears. I know sometimes when we build commercial buildings, we get the concrete poured, we get the outside steel up, and it's almost impossible to talk to anybody in that building because it's a giant garbage can. When you speak, your voice is echoing so much around the room that you literally cannot understand one another more than 30 feet apart. You've got to get next to each other to speak. All of the extra resonation in the room kills the words that you're trying to say to one another. And so that's the way the universe works. We put our energy out there. And everything that will resonate with that energy, whether it's a thought, a dream, a voice, an action, something that we do or think or speak, goes out there in the universe, and everything that will resonate with it will vibrate. Now, a lot of people have come up with ideas that, oh, gee, all you have to do is dream hard enough, think hard enough, think often enough about something, a la The Secret. Cut out the picture out of a magazine, stick it on your refrigerator with a magnet, pass it every time you go for another glass of milk or another piece of cheese out of the refrigerator, hopefully a piece of fruit or something healthy, but not always the case, especially with me. It's pizza or ice cream sandwiches or something. But I do see that thing on the fridge. Oh, yeah, every time. And every time I see it, I go, oh, yeah, that's something I really want to do or I really want to have or I really want to be. Absolutely. I'm all over it. Let me get to that ice cream sandwich now. The fallacy is that if you think about something often enough or you mention it often enough or you write it in the sand often enough, that it will suddenly, over time, materialize. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. That's not the way physics works. That's not the way manifestation works. That's not the way remembering the future works. Here is knowledge, my friends. When you put an energy out into the future, it exists. It does exist because you created it. And everything that will resonate with that will begin vibrating. But you don't go back and hit the bell again. Don't go back and put that thought out there in the future. Don't sit on the front porch and wish to win the lottery every day. Although it's a nice wish, they are going to require you to buy a ticket. You can't win if you don't play. The secret that is in the book Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul Time Travel, which I wrote a year and a half ago, sold pretty well, and a lot of people have gained the benefits of it. The secret is to put the energy into the items that are resonating with your idea. Yeah, it's a little bit different of a thought. In fact, it's a lot different. The bigger the idea, the more things are going to resonate with it. You have to find those things, and you got to add energy to them. Because what's good for the goose is good for the gander. That is to say, if your dream out there in the future resonates with something, the thing that it resonates with your dream. Get it? Now, it might not be the full spectrum. You know, if you play a piece of music on your stereo in your house, let's just say it's a really loud guitar chord. The guitar chord is going to send a series of harmonizing vibrations out into the room from your speakers. Now, if your acoustic guitar happens to be leaning up against the wall in that room outside of its case, eventually one of the strings on that guitar is going to sound like somebody went up to it and plucked it with a pick. That's sympathetic resonation. The interesting thing is that you played a chord, not a note. Several ideas, several frequencies working together in harmony to make a sound, a unified sound that sounds better than any one of those notes by themselves. When they're all played together, you get a chord. It's a lot of different frequencies vibrating at the same time in the same place in a harmonious manner. Not only is that guitar string going to be vibrating, but there's a set of dishes in the cabinet that are going to vibrate. There is a change in the drawer that's going to be vibrating with the lower notes, the E string or the A string on your guitar. You have to learn to listen to those other things that are vibrating, and you got to add energy to those things. When you do, the combination of those vibrations are going to go back to the source, the thing, that the dream that you put out into the future. And the more strings that you can get vibrating to go back sympathetically to the original thought, the original dream, the more solid the dream becomes. Let me put it another way. If you have five sources of energy that come out of a dream that you put into the future, you find two of those things that are sources and you crank up the volume. It's good, but it's not complete. You have to get to all five, and you got to turn the volume up on each of those five, and then the dream will become irrefutably vibrating, which we call manifestation. Hold on one moment. Let me wet my whistle here with some grapefruit juice. Now, the pattern of that vibration is critical. Because if that vibration is off, even just a little bit, the entire cymatic structure of what you're trying to create shatters. It probably won't even look the same. Just to let you know what cymatics are. If you take a tambourine, it has a tight skin stretched across it, or a drum. It's also a good example. Take the tight skin, and on the surface of it, sprinkle a light layer of table salt or sand, just an even layer across it, okay? And then use your voice with a microphone, an amplifier, and a speaker aimed at the drum or the tambourine. Choose different vowels, A, E, I, O, U, you know, all the different sounds that the human voice can make, and sing that at various frequencies into the microphone, like A, E, I, O, U, you know, like that, different sounds like that. Well, those vibrations out of your mouth will get amplified through the microphone, out the speaker, at those frequencies with that tonal quality, with that shape. And that vibration will be sympathetically resonated onto the drum skin or the tambourine skin. Now, visually, what we're going to do is we're going to look at the pattern that's left in the sand or the salt that's on the surface of that skin laying flat. What will happen is the sound waves will be sympathetically shaped on the skin of the drum or the tambourine. And thus, the nodes in that vibration will move the sand or the particles of salt around and create a pattern. That's called cymatics. Now, when that's done at a certain frequency, with a certain tone, with a certain vowel sound, you get different shapes. If you could translate those shapes into those sounds visually, you wouldn't need musical notes on paper. You could simply look at the pattern in the salt or the sand on the surface of the skin, and you could say, oh, that's a B flat, that's a C, okay, you get the idea? That's how you would make the change of vibration. So if the dream or the idea that you're putting out in the future, like I want to be a doctor, I want to be a school teacher, I want to have a new home, I want to buy a new car, I want to have $1 million, which is kind of a silly goal. I will talk about that in a second. You got to have good, worthy dreams. That will have a certain cymatic pattern, so to speak. It will have a certain structure in the universe. Now, you could go about it, building it by hand, maybe, and more than likely, in fact, almost all the time, you're not going to be successful. You're not going to be successful. You're going to be frustrated your whole life, and you're going to feel like the universe just hands you a load of crap that you deal with every single day, and then you die. Hardly worth spending the energy and the time to get in this biological transducer to experience the universe in a physical body. There's got to be more to it than that, and there is. You know, it takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of coordinated energy, a lot of time, and a tremendous amount of things that have to work exactly right in order to get your spirit into a physical body and make it feel like it's having a mortal experience. Do you realize how complex that is? Do you realize that? That a sperm and an egg can come together, form a zygote, which can grow into a fetus, which can end up spewing amniotic fluid out of its nose and mouth, begin breathing air, and within a year walk the earth, within 2 years begin speaking. By then you've forgotten where you came from or who you are. And, you know, you're having a mortal experience. You're an eternal being having a mortal experience. You know how complex that is. Do you know how much energy you have to expend to literally close your eyes into a human body? You notice I didn't say open your eyes into a human body, because I'm not exactly sure, and I've been writing about this for a long, long time, okay? The first time I wrote about it was in 1972, just to give you an idea about the wink of life, whether our eyes are closed or open while we're in mortal form. I mean, when we die, when we actually take our last breath and assume room temperature, are we closing our eyes, really? Or are we opening them? Like, did we close our eyes and say, I'm going to go have a mortal life, or, okay, it's over? Well, yeah, that may have been 100 years in Earth time, but that's about how long it really is, cosmologically speaking. It's a snap of fingers, or less. It's nothing. It's not even close to the age of a star or even a proton. So why would it be significant in the universe? Because it is our consciousness that gets involved in the equation. When we think about the Big Bang, everything in the entire universe, all the matter in the whole universe jammed into one singularity, it really boggles the mind to think about. It just does. And if there was a Big Bang in one spot of zero dimension, or one dimension, boom, and all energy and matter goes racing off in 360 degrees in every direction, what we would see is something not homogeneous. It would be in clumps. It would be in waves. It would be in patterns. It would be in constructively interfering spirals out away from a central point. And I might add, the central point would be pretty darn easy to find. It would be like a cosmic crater. Oh, yeah, here's where the explosion occurred. I just noticed by the mud splatters on all the walls, here's where it went off. Sorry, that doesn't exist in the universe. There is no central place. Everything is leaving everything at an accelerating rate. There's no center point. There's no homogeneity in the universe. There is homogeneity in the universe, which means it's not clumping together the way it would, you know, with an explosion. It has, you know, formed arm's distance from everything else, like an expanding, you know, troop before a parade. What basically, and we're all always looking for that Higgs event, that one, you know, piece of Velcro or rubber band that snapped somewhere in the singularity of the universe and caused the whole thing to come flying apart. It's a theory. I mean, we're just not sure. But one thing that gets thrown into the theory from my point of view, my knowledge, is that human consciousness was involved in the creation of the universe. Now, maybe our consciousness was part of one big consciousness that took the square root of itself an infinite number of times, or a seemingly infinite number of times, to create our individual slices of the one consciousness that makes up the universe. Maybe that's true. But the point is that consciousness and the perspective of consciousness is what created the universe. Time is just distance. It's just distance. When we speak of light years, we're talking about how far light can travel in a year. It's just distance. It isn't really the year. It's not really the time. It's the distance between those things. Well, from the speed of light, all distance collapses to zero as mass increases to infinity. That's a mathematical relationship that's irrefutable, and we've proven it. We've proven it empirically. We've accelerated particles to nearly the speed of light, literally 99.9% of the speed of light. And, for instance, a hydrogen proton goes from one proton to about 1 electron volt to about 1.5 tera electron volts for one proton. And that's about as close to infinity as we can get for a proton. And also about as close to the speed of light as we can get as well. So we understand that from a photon's point of view, there is no distance in the universe. Everything collapses back to the singularity that it once was, which effectively means the Big Bang never happened. This universe is not really there at the speed of light. It's only there at our speed, at the speed that our consciousness has created the universe. So we are integrally tied with creating the universe. Now, I can tell you right now, I just know this without even meeting you, that generally speaking, you're not really happy with the way things have worked out. And if you are, if you really think that everything is perfect in your life, I'd love to hear about it. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Here's the reality. The reality is you have a reality and I have a reality, and everybody living on your block and your building and your city and your town and your nation and your planet have a reality. Whether it's two people dancing on the dance floor, one in absolute bliss and the other one looking at his watch or her watch, or whether it's two people sitting in a movie and one's having a wonderful time and the other one's about ready to fall asleep, or whether two people are listening to music and one is in ecstasy and the other one is, oh my goodness, when is this piece going to end so I can get back to my country or my rap? I wouldn't mix the two because you get crap. The idea is that the universe that we perceive, this physical universe of light and matter and space and gravity and everything, is actually the average or the mean value of all the consciousnesses in it. It's our consciousnesses that bring this together. It's the mixing of all the consciousnesses of all the sentient beings that creates the average reality. We still have our own individual realities. But the average reality of that there's an earth here, and there are roads on the earth, and we can drive on them. There's air that we can breathe, and babies that we can have, and foods that we can eat, and things that we can learn, and water that we can drink, and chocolate that we can enjoy. All of that is the average reality. But the individual reality is what we create ourselves. We either act upon the universe, or we are acted upon by the universe. You make the choice. Nobody makes the choice for you. Whether you are in prison or college or homeless or employed or unemployed or married or unmarried, male or female, black or white, rich or poor, that perception of heaven is in you. And I can tell you right now, it does get better than this, but not much. Now, don't have despair. That's not what I mean. I don't mean this is as good as it gets. That's not what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is that the energy, the design, the patience that we have to go through as eternal beings just to get here on this planet means that it's worth it. Look at the beings that have come here. Look at the beings that have had a mortal existence on this planet. They were eternal beings. Make no mistake about that. Whether it was Jesus, Moses, Abraham, or it was Buddha, or it was Michelangelo, or Leonardo da Vinci, or Mozart, there were moments of ecstasy not related to things that you could do with the physical body. There were moments of ecstasy that could only be experienced in mortal form. Whether it was the love that Jesus had for Mary, whether it was the symphony that Beethoven could see with his eyes on the paper because he couldn't hear it, whether it was the machines and relationships that Leonardo da Vinci drew that he could never build in one lifetime, in his lifetime, in his day, or whether it was the simplest pleasures that you enjoy. These things are created by us. And they are enjoyed by us. They make up the memories of our lives. And you can design them yourself. You don't have to be handed them by anyone else. There's no being out there in space somewhere, you know, saying, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. There's nobody out there saying, you go to heaven, you go to hell, you go to heaven, you go to hell. There's nobody out there like that. You decide whether you are in heaven or in hell. Your energy, your vibration, your consciousness, your state of being judges yourself automatically. That's what you do. That's your function. And so if you feel dark and evil and envious and jealous, nobody made you that way. You made yourself that way. You choose that you want to be charitable and tolerant and loving and peaceful, or you choose if you're going to be violent and warlike and envious and jealous. That's your choice. Nobody makes you that way. And if you find yourself that way, all of a sudden you wake up in the middle of halfway through an oatmeal cookie and you say, hey, I'm envious. I hate that person because they're skinny and good looking. I hate that person because he's rich and I'm not. I don't like that country. I don't like that leader. I don't like my boss. That's the kind of energy that will judge you so fast because it will change your energy based on your choice. You cannot resonate with wealth if you are manifesting poverty on yourself all the time. You can never have a meaningful relationship with the opposite sex, or same sex for that matter, if you are hating yourself. Can't happen. I mean, maybe that person will see in you what you could become and thus love you. But if they can't make you into what they see you becoming in their own eyes, you're not going to stay together. At some point, that person is going to say, you know, I thought I could do it. I thought I could change you. I thought I could teach you to love yourself, but I can't. And thus, I cannot be with you anymore. Even the great masters, even Jesus, what we have of his writings, if they're not completely altered, told us what the two great commandments are. They already told us that. We have it in writing. And you know what? They feel right, and I'm going with it. The two great commandments, when recited in the order in which they were said, are love yourself. Love yourself. And when you love yourself, you will feel an overwhelming love for others, and you will love them. And when you're doing that, you're loving God with all your heart, might, and mind, and strength. That's it. It cannot go the other way. You can't love God and then love your neighbor and then love yourself. It doesn't work that way. If you don't love yourself, love can go nowhere with you. Okay? That's where it starts. That's where it starts. So if you've got these envious, nasty, jealous, hateful feelings every day, even hating yourself, it's going to resonate with the universe just as easily, just as well, and unfortunately, just as effectively. But if you can dream those large dreams, if you can say, I want to be an asteroid miner, I want to build and make something, I want to teach other people, I want to help other people, I want to design a home that's energy efficient, I want to create or discover a new way to access energy that we don't have to burn a fossil fuel to make it. I want to have a new car. I want to have a new house. Those kinds of things. Those are easy to manifest. Yes, the big ones take a little bit more work. It's not like sitting down on the front porch and squatting one out. It doesn't work that way. The bigger the dream, the more complex the dream, the more energy it takes, the more persistence you have to have in finding those things that resonate with your dream and adding energy to them. Because if you do, from a physics point of view, your dream has no choice but to manifest. It must manifest because it is a mathematical, absolute surety, a formula that cannot fail. Just like adding 2 + 2, you must get 4. Just by multiplying 3 × 9, you must get 27. It has no choice. It has no choice. The same thing happens with energy, and the same thing that we realize that we know for a fact, we know this for a fact, consciousness and the application of consciousness is energy. So if you could add consciousness in a prescribed formulaic way, it must produce results. It has no choice. And if it doesn't produce results, it's easy to say, well, you're doing something wrong. Yes, you are. You're doing something wrong because you're leaving some critical or key input out of it. No, it isn't the money. You don't have to go out and get $1 million first. You resonate on what it is you're trying to build, what you're trying to do, what you're trying to be. And the resources for getting it done will resonate with it. What you have to do is find those resources that are revenue, that are resonating with your idea, and apply energy to them. If you do, the thing that you're trying to manifest has no choice whatsoever in coming to be. And so we can do this not only in the future, but we can also do it in the past. You remember I told you it's the same distance from here to Atlanta as it is from Atlanta to here, Charlotte, or somewhere east of the Appalachians? It is. However, the past in our consciousness, in memory, has already occurred. In fact, you may already be carrying the scars of that past. You might be missing a finger or an eye. You might be missing a pet. And you might be missing something even more dear to you. Can't get around that. Can't change that. But you can change the way you react to it. You can change the way you remember it. No, I don't mean going back and saying, hey, that never happened. No, that never happened. I don't mean that. I mean, within the parameters of reality, within the parameters of what actually happened, is a perception of what actually happened. And you can clear how that perception prevents you from achieving your dream. Hold on one moment. In other words, if you did something in the past and you said, well, I'm never going to do that again, you may already have set up the pattern to virtually 100% guarantee you are going to do that again. If you're a female and you have had a relationship with a person who physically abused you, you might say to yourself, nobody's touching my face again. I am not doing that. I am not going to be attracted to an abuser again. You may have already set up the pattern by which that's exactly the kind of person you're going to be attracted to or is going to be attracted to you. It's sort of like when somebody goes onto a car lot. I used to sell cars in my college day. I know a lot about the automotive business. I have somebody come in and I'd say, well, what are you looking for? You know what? I'm looking for, I don't really know. Whatever it is, I don't want it to be green. I don't want a green car. You know what I used to do? I'd take them to the whole row of green cars I could find. Because the fact that they've said, I'm not having a green car. I had one time, but it's a piece of crap. I'm not going to buy a green car. I know in my mind that they've already set themselves up to buy a green car. So I take them to the green cars and green trucks first. 9 times out of 10, I close them. Was I taking advantage of them? Maybe. But, you know, they were manifesting the green. Hold on one second. Sometimes the vocal cords can take 3 hours of this, and sometimes they can't. So if you have that pattern, and you don't want to continue the results of it, you don't want to be acted upon by the universe. You want to act on the universe, and so you want to be cleared of that energy. It might take a professional. I don't mean a psychologist. Forget about that. I mean a professional clearing practitioner, somebody who listens and can measure the energy on your body, in your system, with electronic means, sensing the energy. No matter how your voice sounds, sensing the energy inside of you when you speak about or recall or answer those questions. Once that energy is sensed, a professional can find the blocks or the mirrors, we call them, things that reflect that energy back and forth inside of us. They won't let it go through like glass. They reflect it back on ourselves, making us stay in that script or that mindset or that pattern that we have brought forward with us. Now, keep in mind that that pattern can go back well beyond one mortal life. You know, you are an eternal being having a mortal experience. I didn't say you are an eternal being having the one and only mortal experience you're ever going to have. It is reasonable against and in the face of all dogma that you may be loaded in your backpack that you pack around every day with you of prejudices and interpretations and filters that have been laid upon you by the traditions of your religion or your social group. I'm talking about the real eternity. the eternity that lasts for way longer than one lifetime. You have experience that you bring with you to this mortal existence. Make no mistake about that. Jesus made that perfectly clear to us when he came here. He told us who he was, and he didn't spend a whole lot of time on his divinity. Really, he didn't. He spent more time on our divinity, on trying to tell us who we were, where we came from, who we're related to. Yeah, you can't remember it because I told you. You don't really learn to speak until you're two or three. You don't even learn to think. You don't even step into this biological transducer until the age of 9 or 10. And I would say from there on, as hormones are poured into your system and they screw with every interpretation and, of course, your language. No, it's true. If you're a parent, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. You get a teenager, don't forget to open the hermetically sealed, for freshness, package of headphones. You wear the headphones, and it converts teenager speech into normal speech. It's the only way to keep from getting pissed off. Try it. It comes with every teenager. They're in the package. You just take them out, put them on, and every word that is said by your teenager will be converted into normal, unoffensive speech. When you do that, then you can respond back to your teenager, who will automatically stop talking like that as soon as the hormone levels even out in their body, somewhere around age 19 or 20 for most people. And then they become human again. They become sentient. At that point, they can look back and say, wow, Dad, hey, listen, when I was 17, you know, I said this and I acted that way. I'm really sorry about that, but I couldn't see it. You have to be mature enough as now an informed adult mortal human being to say, no problem, son. I put on my special teenage headphones and I understood exactly what you meant to say, not what actually came out of your mouth. The point is that we bring experience forward with us from past realities, from past mortalities. Now, I don't know if we lived to be 100 years or 1,000 years in past lives, whether we were on this planet or other planets, but we do bring that experience forward with us, which means we also bring patterns forward with us. We also bring scripts forward with us. Whether we have always been a warrior or whether we have always been prey to warriors, whether we have been in the ruling class and at the head of management and leadership and economics, or whether we have been a serf, you know, pounding wheat into flour for the aristocrats, so to speak, in different ways, in different languages, in different planets, in different things that we might have been involved with. We bring that experience forward with us. We also bring the mirrors, the habits, the fears, the things that we said we would never do again. They're ingrained in our spirit being. And when they become manifest in a mortal being, it's, could be a little bit of like father, like son, or like great-grandfather, like great-grandson. That is there. It's undeniable, irrefutable. And anybody that believes any other thing, it's just belief. And belief is nothing. Belief means nothing. It is like so much bad gas, okay? Belief doesn't move anything. Now, you could say, oh, I believe, therefore I am saved. Utter, complete nonsense. And if you want to go back and read the scriptures for yourself, read them again, because even the devils do believe and tremble. Just because the devils know that Jesus is the Christ does not save them. Why? Because, you know, belief doesn't do anything. You must have knowledge and you must act on that knowledge one way or the other, or not. You can ignore it. You can ignore that you know. Or you can act against your knowledge, the knowledge that you have, based on your will. Or you can act upon that knowledge and gain benefit and wisdom from it and move forward. Knowledge is the only thing that counts. Belief is nothing. Get past it. If you're just a believer and not a knower, you're not ready. You're not ready. Get past the belief and get a pure knowledge. In the Old Testament, it's called a calling and election made sure. Once you have your calling and election made sure, you already know. Judgment is already done. You've already judged yourself by what you know, by what you do, and what you act on. Everything that goes in your mouth is not what corrupts you. It's what comes out of your mouth that corrupts you. Okay? That's where the power of those words is. So, the fact that you have existed for a long time, perhaps thousands and thousands of millennia, the fact that you bring lessons, very powerful lessons, not the little stuff like how to tie your shoes or how to build a spacecraft or how to extract berry juice, you know, on the planet X bar. But the important things, like I was a warrior and I have a spiritual agility toward moving objects to defend myself and to take action against others. That's one thing. But to get an erection or to have some kind of ecstasy that comes to you the instant you inflict physical harm on another human being is something pathological. That needs to be professionally cleaned from your memory so that you can get through that mirror, through the glass, onto the other side and continue to grow with your development. You can grow past it if you get to it early enough and if you talk to someone who will get past this mortal life into the last mortal life and find out where that pattern came from. Some of it, I'm sure, can be quite traumatic, but it can be done. So, we've covered a lot of information in this hour, and I know you've sat out there and listened faithfully, and I thank you. Thank you so much for being part of the program tonight. I know the network out there is quite full of people sitting there listening passively. I see you out there. Not really, but I mean, I know you're out there. Our phone number here is 888-429-5471, and we are out of time. We have to make room for the next host to come on. So we will see you next month, the first Sunday of May, right here on X Squared Radio. Be good, my friends. We'll see you then. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.